Pop the we might say the meanest things. Pop the sometimes when not much company. There's no rearranging, our writing remains the same. We remain the same. And as far as we're concerned, Pop the you belong to us. Pop the
hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 20 of the Pop Does Podcast. I'm Dave Lifton, and that's right, we've now reached 20 episodes of this show, which means that if you've listened to them all back-to-back, we'd be wondering what the hell is wrong with you. And by we, I'm referring, of course, to my co-hosts, Jeff Giles and Jason Hare. Gentlemen.
Well, hello! Fuckers? Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening. Has it really been 20 episodes?
That's right. September will be the start of the second year, which means we've also missed 4 months, which is surprising because I thought we've missed more than that.
Only four.
It feels like longer. It feels like we've done 30 episodes.
I know. Well, I just realized that, like, this is now my... I just went into, like, my fifth year of podcasting. Because I launched my first one in February of 06, and my second one started in August of 06.
You are an old man in every technology there is.
I know. You know, I did take, like, what was it, 9 months off or whatever.
Well, that was to have a baby. Just looks like you never got to the giving birth part.
I was about to say it, I never got rid of the baby weight. I'll often say I'm in my 15th trimester.
I've noticed you've been out biking quite a bit, Dave.
Yes, good on you, Dave.
Thank you.
Although I always think you're lying now because you told us that those bike rides that you're counting are actually bus rides.
No, I have not taken the bus. No, those are actual bike rides. I do that. I'm going to go out later in the afternoon today. But it has been I had to rest my legs for a while because they just to deal with some nagging injuries, like an ankle injury.
The warranty on your hip expired.
I've done so little bike riding this year.
You've been doing everything else, you madman.
Well, I've been doing it as part of everything else, but like I used to focus solely on biking, and now it's a little bit of everything.
I haven't talked to you since the triathlon.
Yeah, I was gonna say that. I even have that written in my notes to genuinely congratulate Jason on doing the New York City triathlon last week, and once again raising money for Leukemia and Lymphoma Society.
That's right. Yeah, thanks, Dave.
And it's great. I mean, you beat last year's time by 15 minutes.
20 minutes.
20 minutes. Damn.
20 minutes. Well, that'll never happen again. That was mainly because last year I had so many foot injuries that I ran like a 10 and a half minute mile, and this year I ran an 8 minute mile.
Wow.
So, you know, it's not like next year I'm going to run like a 5 and a half.
One.
Right, exactly.
Do it.
So, yeah, do it.
Right.
Just forget about your legs. Just do what you got to do.
Yeah, this is more where you should be, is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah, I think so.
So what's next?
What's next? No races for a while. I started.
You're
a new
goal-oriented
job.
Guy. I can't believe you haven't already lined something up.
I know. Well, I started a new job a couple months ago, and this job.
That's right. You're part of a service team.
That's right. I'm part of a service team. I have a job that I genuinely love, and I love everything about the company. I really believe in it, and I love all the people. But it's a lot of work. So I'm pulling like 10 to 12 to sometimes 15 hour days. So
wow.
It's been a little bit crazy.
Jason is, he's cleaning the subway.
No, I'm cleaning the Hudson River. I don't know if you guys saw that a couple of weeks before the triathlon, there was like some waste treatment plant or something had a fire and like all this sewage got dumped into the Hudson. And
that's
so for
disgusting.
A while there, it's terribly disgusting. Now, and like the Hudson is disgusting enough already, but there was a lot of discussion of them canceling the swim. But apparently they tested the water. Everything was fine except for the two people that died. That's not a joke. Two people died.
Oh, really?
Yeah, not because of the sewage. Two people had heart attacks actually.
Oh, geez.
During the swim portion, and one died right there, and one died like a couple of days later.
Oh, you know what? I think I saw that in the news, and I was going to say that it was your fault, but I
was
figured
fault.
That would be in very bad taste. So.
So say it now.
I think I just did.
Yeah, it was crazy. And, of course, everyone's like, now they have to do a thorough investigation of the triathlon and all this stuff. But, the triathlon is actually quite safe.
Don't you have to sign a waiver of some kind?
Yes, you have to sign waivers and all that kind of stuff.
Right. You shouldn't be doing a triathlon if you're susceptible to the heart attack.
Right.
And,
right. Yeah, exactly. You gotta be careful.
Well, another thing I wanted to tell you is that I actually followed your example and did a triathlon of my own the other day.
Yes, tell me about that, Dave.
Yes, the first leg consisted of me eating an entire barbecue dinner. It was a full slab of ribs, cornbread, beans, and slaw. The second involved washing it down with half a bottle of bourbon.
Excellent.
And the third was when I shat it all out.
Did you pass out on the toilet like Jason did?
No, but I did set a personal record for that, too.
Nice.
Thank you.
You PR'd on the toilet. Well done. Well, you know, everyone has to have their goals and achievements, and I think this is a notable one. So,
and most of mine involve barbecue. Well,
I think it'd be pretty awesome if you're wearing, like, a race number.
I'll write the number in my arm in barbecue sauce.
Number 265.
Yeah.
Right.
What was your bourbon?
It was Maker's Mark. Well, it goes well with barbecue. That bite just gets you.
Ha. Huh. I had water and Gatorade.
Nah, Gatorade and barbecues suck together.
Ooh, that sounds terrible.
Yeah.
That sounds terrible.
Did you ever read about that guy who tried to run a marathon drinking beer as he went?
I heard about that, and I'm just thinking, you're a fucking idiot.
Yeah, I think he tried to drink a beer for every mile.
Yeah.
That sounds like something that would come up like...
Yeah, it would come up all right.
Yeah, right. That sounds like something that would happen if you worked in finance. And someone's like, someone's like, hey, well, dare you to,
Yeah, you'd have to be like the alpha male both for fitness and drinking for that. And that lends itself to finance people.
Well, I don't know. I think you just have to be surrounded by people that want to dare you to do stupid things, just for macho reasons.
I think at some point the paramedics got involved and took him off the course. And I think I remember him being really angry about that. But I don't remember how far he got.
There are specific races where you're allowed to be stupid, where it's encouraged to be stupid, to drink through the race or, other races which are more foolhardy, but a real marathon or a real triathlete, it's just bullshit.
Yeah. That makes no sense to me whatsoever.
A bad idea. I completed another, marathon, the other day, which was, listening to Rosalita.
How many times?
I can't even tell you how many times I've listened to Rosalita in the past week.
Me neither. But that's every week for
it's
me.
It's Dave's ringtone.
It is.
So, is it really?
Yes.
Which part? Which part?
The opening.
All of
the
it. Opening.
The whole thing.
That's right. I wait 8 minutes before.
to explain to our listeners, Poptos columnist Molly Marinick is getting married, and she has hired Acoustic 80s to play at her wedding and asked us to play some non-80s songs, and Rosalita was on there. And I was like, I don't really know if I've ever heard this song before. So I went and I listened to it. And I was really upset to find out how much I liked it.
Why were you upset? Because it meant that I'm right?
Yes. Well, also because you know how I am about Bruce Springsteen. I'm like, I think he's great, just not really a fan of his music. But
I have no problem with that. That's why, in my emails to you about this, when you were asking me for the chart, I was just like, hey, enjoy it.
Right. No, I do, and I actually went back and listened to the whole album, and I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it.
I thought you were a fan. I thought your problem was just that you were surrounded by so many fans that every time Springsteen does anything, you have to hear about it. 400 times.
It doesn't help.
That does irritate me. But no, I was never actually a Springsteen fan. I mean, I don't have anything against his music. Just wasn't really a fan. But I've listened to that album now quite a lot. And I think the E Street Shuffle is a great song.
It is.
I'm like, God, this is actually funky. I'm like surprised by it.
This is a really appropriate milestone for our 20th episode.
Well, that album is unlike anything else in his catalog. So now you don't have to go and investigate the rest of it. because right after that was, that's his worst selling album ever.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Worse than the Seeger Sessions record?
Yeah, I think so. At least up to one point for years, that was his worst selling album. Because, remember, Born to Run didn't break. He was going to get dropped.
Yeah.
but, you know, like the, right around that time, like they met Landau and it was just like about, oh, you know, make a rock album, make a rock and roll album rather than this kind of Van Morrison on the Jersey Shore type of thing, which is what Wildly Innocent East Street Shuffle is, with, of course, a tuba added in the middle.
Well, I had to listen to Rosalita so many times because the structure is just so weird.
It's a suite. It's basically a suite.
Yeah, and I'm really happy to tell you this, that after I listened to it, I was like, you know what this reminds me of? Meatloaf.
Well, yeah. I understand that because it. I mean, didn't a lot of the East Street Band played on that album?
That's right.
Meatloaf had all of the form and none of the function.
And none of the songs.
Right. I just meant, like, you look at a song like Rosalita, and it's not too dissimilar from a song like Bat Out of Hell, where, like, you've got your fast sections, your slow sections that kind of come out of nowhere. It builds back up. You know, you've got so much going on in that song.
Jason, did I send you the news story about Meatloaf making a Christmas album?
Oh, God.
No.
Yep.
For this year?
Yeah.
Mellow Mas, Mellow Mas, Mellow Mas.
Yeah, well, obviously, Meatloaf Mas. Meat Mas.
Meat Mas.
It takes up 2 days.
It does. Going in and then coming out.
How much would you give for Meatloaf to cover Fruitcake? How awesome would that be?
How much would he have to pay me?
One of you guys should look it up, because he's got some pretty interesting duet partners lined up. I think maybe Dolly Parton?
Of course, because who else is she going to record with this year for Christmas?
He has a couple of country stars that are going to be recording with him on this.
Garth Brooks, I guess? Reuben McEntire?
There you go.
Yeah.
Who else?
I think those are it. And then he's making another record where he's going to be working with, I think, like Lil Wayne and Chuck D or something.
Oh, what? Looks like the album is called Hot Holidays. Why would he call the album Hot Holidays? Why wouldn't he call it, like, A Meatloaf Christmas? That would be the perfect title.
Because ham is a traditional Christmas dish.
Just seems like there's so much you could do with meatloaf, you know? A very meatloaf holiday.
I'm sure whatever can be done with it, we'll do.
Meatloaf mistletoe. I don't know.
Meatloaf under the mistletoe.
Merry meatloaf.
Merry meatloaf.
When are you coming back out to Long Island, Dave?
I don't have any plans. My ability to travel is so limited.
Oh, that's right. You're on the no-fly list, right?
Yeah.
He's got to pay for 2 seats.
He was a Confederate soldier, and I don't think they allow them to fly. If you came back to Long Island, then I think it would be great to have you and me and Jason together to do a live show with Gary.
Oh, that would be perfect.
My dad was so pleased with the reception from our last episode.
And rightly so. People flipped out. People are still talking about it.
Yeah.
He would, for a while there, he was calling me every day. I mean, like, he wouldn't go to the website, but he would call me every day and ask me, like, if there were any more comments about the podcast.
He wouldn't go to the website. That's great.
Well, I mean, it's not like he was like, I'm not going to the website. He just, like, he didn't think of it, you know? And, The best, actually, I think, Jeff, I think I told you this on the phone last week, but the best was like a week or two. You know, whenever I get together with my parents, my dad will go through the list. He's like, how is so-and-so, and how is so-and-so, and what do you hear from so-and-so? So he goes, and how are Jeff and Dave? Like, you guys are a couple.
Does he realize that you and Jeff are a couple?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. He wants to know how. He wasn't going to be like, how are Jeff and you? You know, like, how are Jeff and Dave? Like the two of them. You know,
say hi to him for me next time.
I certainly will.
Okay,
I certainly will. He was he had a lot of fun. Aruba,
I'm guessing you guys both saw the episode of Louis.
Yes.
No, I did not see that yet. Don't tell me about it.
I will tell you about it, but it's just...
I'm an brilliant episode behind, but God, I love that show.
Yes.
He's just so good. And every time I watch it, I go, wow. He wrote it. He directed it. He edited it.
He's starring it?
He's starring it. His acting is great.
Yeah. Sometimes I wonder how much he's acting.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
It's hard to tell.
There are moments like certain reactions and stuff where you see that there's, but the character he's playing is essentially...
It's a version of him. But, you know, like when he gave that, the last episode I saw was the one where he explains to Pamela.
Yes.
How much in love with her he is. And
Oh my God, that was great.
So poetic. It reminded me of that other episode where he talked to that girl about how he saw the guy get hit by a car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His ability to deliver monologues like that just so completely organically and honestly.
Yeah.
It's really good.
We called it last year. This is a brilliant show.
Yeah, that's right.
That's true.
You guys did. That was when I started watching it after that, and you guys were absolutely right about that. I think I'd meant to... say in the next episode, hey, thanks for turning me on to that. But that was when we ended up taking those 3 months
right.
off.
Right.
So a year later, thanks for turning me on to Louis.
The show, he just allows it to, he allows the show to be ugly, which is really nice. You know, and I love the fact that he said, you know, I don't really care what kind of money you give me. Just give me a show. Like, I'll do the show for whatever it is and whatever network or whatever. You just can't touch it. You know, you just have to, you take what I give you. You know, and that's what it is.
And it's natural because he's not telling the story in 30 minutes with a beginning, a middle, and a resolution.
Right.
He's just doing these little vignettes that that overall kind of give the impression of a story, and that allows him to have a little bit more control and a little bit more realism.
Yeah, I just love that he's brave enough to not be funny.
And he's brave enough to say... life is fucking miserable.
He says that, but then the episodes, they're just kind of sprinkled with these moments of real
beauty,
poetry.
Yeah.
The thing of him singing The Who in the car.
When he's telling his daughter, you're not allowed to be bored.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is funny, but then he slips in this little monologue about how incredible life is. And then, you know, the monologue to Pamela about why he loves her, and that whole episode when he's in the car with his daughters and they go to visit that racist old lady.
That's so funny.
It's played for laughs, but not really played for laughs. I don't know. Yeah. It's such a great show.
Yeah, yeah. It's so unique.
Well, I loved it. What was the opening scene of this season where he's, helping his daughter get ready for bed, and she's like, when am I going to go back to mommy's house? I love it there. I like it there more. It's more fun. And then, like, she walks away and he flips her off.
Well, he's been playing that routine for a long time about how his kids are assholes, but
kids are assholes, man.
This one goes out to all our hipster fans. Thank you for listening to Popo's. You suckers, now fuck off.
Okay, on the last episode, I hinted that there was a possibility that my mother could appear on the show because she was visiting me at the time, but she wasn't into the idea. I think she still hasn't forgiven Jason for what he said about her cooking. You can say whatever you want about her sexually, but insult her cooking or the cleanliness of her house, and you know she just doesn't forgive you for that. So instead, we've asked an old friend of ours to join us in the fun here. Peter Lubin is a veteran of the music business. As an A&R man and producer, he has worked with such names as Peter Gabriel, the Moody Blues, John Mellencamp, the Pixies, Fish, They Might Be Giants, and Def Leppard, and other people that Jason can't stand. Peter Lubin, welcome to the Pop Dose Podcast.
Oh, thanks, fellas. It's wonderful to be here. It's certainly a thrill.
Take us home with you. So, Pete, how did you get started in the industry?
Oh, that old saw, that old tale. When I was a kid, I'll do the capsule version if I can. When I was a kid, and I'm talking about 12 years old, I discovered something that changed my world, which was if you wrote about records, they'd send them to you for free.
Yep.
And that was life-altering to me. But, of course, when you're 12 years old, nobody's going to let you write about records. So me and a buddy... we set about inventing our own fanzine. This was at the very dawn. We're talking about 1971, maybe. we're talking about the very dawn of rock journalism. And so we invented a paper called the New Haven Rock Press. And oddly, much to our amazement, it caught on. A lot of famous writers over the years wrote for our paper, and we in turn wrote for theirs, and it was a big happy community. So people that contributed to us were like Lester Bangs and John Landau, the manager of Springsteen, and John Pareles and Nick Tosches, who's a great novelist now, and many, many people. And so in that fashion, I became acquainted with the record industry, and any group or artist that came to town, I mean, we owned that little slice of heaven, New Haven, Connecticut. Anybody that came to town, we had access to, and so we could interview them, and we knew the managers and the publicists, and we'd go up and visit the record companies, and it just grew and grew and grew, and that's how I got sucked into the trade.
It's very cool. Nick Tosches is somebody who fascinates me because I read his biography of Dean Martin, which is just one of the bravest biographies I've ever read by anybody.
It's fantastic, right? And have you read the Sonny Liston?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, that's great too.
I love the way he just put yourself in Martin's head.
Exactly.
Like the whole idea of, I don't give a fuck. All I care about is getting blowjobs. It's like, big deal. You want me to be a method? You want me to act in a movie? You want me to be a cowboy? Fine, just give me a hat and I'll be a cowboy. I don't care.
He had the greatest attitude, no question.
Yeah. But the ability to convey that effectively was what made that book so great.
The first time I met Nick, he was sitting in a drafting table in an office on Lexington Avenue. He was designing brassieres.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you design them
with the tool with a protractor
and a compass and
Dave, yeah. you could have been a model for him.
Oh my god!
At the time that he met him, I did not have man boobs. I was a scrawny little shit.
All right. So at any rate, one thing led to another, and when I left college, actually this paper that we had been writing, we turned it into a record label called Big Sound Records. This was at the dawning of Stiff Records, and it was cool to be independent and all that stuff. So,
Jason, Stiff Records was an independent label in...
Got it.
Okay. I haven't used that joke in a long time.
That's true.
So we put out... Oh, I'm sorry. We put out... a few records until I had $25 left in my name. The thing about the label was, of course, there were three or four of us, and we did everything. I mean, from mailing out the packages, to phoning the radio stations, to sweeping the floor of the studio, to sleeping on the studio floor. And so when I was down to nothing... Oh, but the thing about it was... We knew everybody that worked at the trade magazines, at Billboard and Cashbox at the time, and Record World. So what we would do, because it was funny, of course, and hip to be irreverent like Stiff was, so we would write these funny press releases, and we'd send them out to the trades. But the thing about the press releases was they would contain a boring kernel of truth. For example, we're now distributed by Schwartz Brothers of Cleveland, Ohio, or some such thing. And the guys at the trades would be entertained by our stuff, and so they would rewrite it for us, and they would put it in the magazine. So when I was down to my last $25 in the world, I did get a phone call from a publicist, a somewhat legendary a guy who owned his own publicity company. He was called Howard Bloom. He had a company, the Howard Bloom Organization. And he called me to ask, well, who does your publicity? Because he was very jealous. Any press at all, any ink to this guy was like liquid gold. And so he wanted to know how we were getting so much coverage in the trades and whatnot. And I said, well, that's me. I do everything. I lick the postage stamps. I whatever. And he said, well, you know, do you want a job? And quite honestly, being a publicist was the furthest thing from my agenda. You know, to me, publicist was something you had to have removed surgically or something. I didn't want to spend my life begging writers like you lot, you know. So, it was a port in a storm. And so he said, well, if you're at my staff meeting at 10 a.m. Tomorrow morning, then you have a job. So I packed a toothbrush and a shirt, and I went to New York City, and I never came back. And that's how that started. I held the record for getting in and out of Bloom the fastest. I got hired by Columbia Records to do tour publicity after about 8 or 9 months. And then I was working in the vaunted halls of CBS Records, where, you know, if you want to know the truth, I was too intimidated. I mean, these were guys, I'd been reading Billboard magazine since I was 12 years old, and these were legendary record guys that I'd read about every week in and week out, and so I couldn't use the men's room on the Columbia Records floor. I swear to God, I used to go to the TV floor, you know, because it was just too overwhelming to have, you know, whoever it was, Bruce Lundvall or whoever it was, wow, come in and take a pee next to me, you know. So
yeah, I could take a leak next to Walter Cronkite, but
who cared about him? Yeah, no question.
Right, but Walter Yetnikoff, nah.
Exactly.
The beard intimidated me.
Yetnikoff peed out the window.
On recording artists.
what time frame was this when you were at CBS?
I joined CBS in 1979 and left them in 1980. And the reason I left them was there was a woman on the...
Because you were tired of holding it in.
You know, I'll tell you, you just reminded me. That gig made me so anxious you know, I ended up having all kinds of anxiety-related physical ailments that I remember resulted in what I used to refer to as the barium everywhere test.
Oh God!
Yeah. So yeah, they that's how uptight I was to be walking among giants. You know.
Right.
But anyway, what happened was, one of the women in the publicity department, my closest friend, was she happened to get engaged to and then marry the head of promotion at Columbia Records, which was a very, very powerful job because you controlled, you know, radio play for Columbia Records. That was a big gig. His name was Bob Sherwood, a fantastic guy. And suddenly one day, his wife, Carol, calls me into her office, and she says, shut the door. I said, okay. And she says, you have to answer a question for me. I said, what? She said, what's a polygram?
Oh, God.
And I said, well, believe it or not, over on 7th Avenue, where no one dared tread at the time, there is a building, and in that building, yeah, there's a record company, and overseas, it's the biggest, best record company in the world. Here, it's Mercury and Polydor. But there, huge. She said, well, you know, Bob was just asked to be the president of Mercury Records. And I said, well, wow, you know, that's a challenge. And 2 weeks later, after he took the gig, he called me up. He said, hey, sport, you want to be our director of A&R? You know, and I was 20, I was 23 years old, I think, at the time. And I said, sure. I know all about doing that job. So so I went there. You know, I got the gig, and that started the A&R career, in answer to your question.
Okay.
If you have a follow-up question, I'll try to answer that too.
No, I think it's pretty amazing just looking at this roster of people, just these names that I found on the internet from some that was from somewhere else. and what strikes me is that there's no defining sound. It's like I think of A&R guys, you know, I guess the definitive one would be John Hammond, and you always associate him with folk and blues and things and jazz and things that all kind of fell into that category in some form or another, but you can't really put any you really can't put that on the list of acts that you worked with.
See, I don't look at it that way. I look at what John Hammond did as the best of its breed, or, you know, the best that was available to him. I don't see him as pigeonholed in a thing. Benny Goodman and Bruce Springsteen are not that similar, except that they're both, you know, gifted. So,
but if you look at it, did you read Dunstan Priel's book, The Producer, his biography of him?
No.
He made it an interesting. He basically said that Hammond's world was all about integration, and it was all about, you know, like.
He used to climb out his window, purportedly of his mansion and his Astor mansion, and go to the Apollo, you know, and sneak in when he was a kid.
Right, but like if you look at the black roots of Benny Goodman and Dylan, you know, just like the whole idea of coming from the jazz blues, and then you see Springsteen as the logical successor to Dylan, then it all kind of fits into a narrative there that spreads 50 years, but or 40 years, or whatever.
Okay, but then so does the good stuff. You know what I mean? I mean, it all comes right from Louis Armstrong, if you want to go back to the Mississippi Delta. So it's part of a continuum, and John Hammond plucked certain things off of that continuum and put them on Columbia Records where they belonged, you know?
Right. But it's like they might be Giants and Def Leppard are two incredibly disparate bands, and then the Moody Blues on top of that. That's just what strikes me so much, and Fish. That's just something that strikes me as being so interesting about your the people you've worked with.
Well, you know, they all have their different stories as to how they or why they were acquired. The Moody Blues, for example, if you want to continue the sort of jogger knot that I was on, you know, this little journey that I took, to quickly explain it, when I was at Howard Bloom, he never had good clients. He always had the B-list client. In other words, he didn't have Peter Gabriel, but he had the Larry Fast, the synthesizer wizard from Peter Gabriel's band. And so I became Larry Fast's publicist. He didn't have the Moody Blues, but he had Patrick Mraz, the journeyman keyboard player from the Moody Blues. Now, Patrick Mraz was a great, great guy and very loving and you know, Peter, you are my friend, you know, my publicist, you know, that sort of thing. And it, big bear hugs, you know, Patrick, you know. So I got to know the Moody Blues by way of Patrick Mraz. What happened was I got to Mercury Records, and Bob Sherwood calls me one morning and he says, I won't be available until, so I have to fly to London. The Moody Blues are available and we're going to, you know, see about signing them. And I said, well, when you get there, say hi to Justin and John and Patrick for me. And he said, you know these guys? And I said, oh yeah, I know these guys. He said, pack your bags, you're on the Concorde with me in the morning, we're going to go.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and so I took the Concorde to London. We walked into Threshold Studios, which was a room at Decca Studios that the Moody Blues owned. And there was a conference room table set up, and the Moody Blues were all sitting around the conference room table. And I walked in, and God bless him, Patrick Mraz jumps up and says, Peter, my publicist pal, how are you? You know, and Justin, John, it is Peter, our main man, you know? And because of that, they said, we'll go with him, you know?
Yeah.
And the thing was, you know, Mercury Records needed sales and artists. It was, when I first got there, it's very funny because when I first got there, it wasn't selling very many records, the label wasn't. But the artist roster had things on it that were eventually going to sell millions and millions of records. It had John Cougar, it had Def Leppard, Scorpions, whoever and whoever. It had these were all gonna be, oh, Kool and the Gang, they were all gonna be platinum acts. They just weren't yet. And the Moody Blues, we just looked at them as maybe we can add a quick, you know, 300,000 units to the bottom line if we grab these guys. They were on the balls of their ass at the time. They had done a record called Octave, and Octave was a complete disaster. And their manager, who was Jerry Weintraub, had booked them on a tour of arenas, you know, across the country. For example, they were playing Madison Square Garden to maybe 2,200 people or some such thing. Yeah, it was a disaster. And so that's where they were at when we acquired them, and they made this record called Long Distance Voyager, which I got to tell you guys, I was too embarrassed to listen to for 20 years. I just always thought of it as, you know, that thing that happened once. But I had to get a copy of it recently for some other radio interview. And it pops up on my iTunes now occasionally, a track does. And you know something? It's not half bad.
I'm looking it up right now. It's the one with the voice. I remember.
Yeah,
that,
the voice. And the lead single was called Gemini Dream, which is quite a good track as well. But, you know, it was the same thing. Larry Fast from Peter Gabriel's band. So, okay, Sherwood and I were in London, and we were doing this Moody Blues deal. And at the time, Games Without Frontiers by Peter Gabriel was the number one single in England. Now, what had happened was Atlantic Records had thrown Peter Gabriel off the roster because he delivered that album, his third solo album, and his A&R guy there. Back in those days, you had the ability to deem an album commercially unacceptable. If the record was thought to be not in the style that you were commercially known for, you had then delivered a record that was commercially unacceptable, and you could pay the consequences contractually. And when Gabriel delivered that album, that's what they thought of it, and they chucked him from the label. Now, because they did, no other label in America would touch that guy. He looked like a waffle from people poking him with a 10-foot pole. And
that's funny, because that album is fantastic.
Right, exactly. So we are in London together, and we're riding in a cab. Oh, okay. So at Howard Bloom, another one of my clients was a guy, a fantastic, fabulous man who doesn't get enough credit in the history of the record biz, a guy named Tony Stratton Smith. He was the founder of Charisma. Exactly. Yeah. And he had a lot of charisma himself. He was a big, portly man, a fabulous raconteur. When he came to town, it was drinks all around. We would all convene at the Bombay Palace, in the bar of the Bombay Palace, and everyone was welcome, and everyone came by. Amit would come by, and guy named Tunj Aram, who ran Rolling Stones Records at the time, he would come by, and all these people, and Tony would buy drinks all around, and he poured me into a taxi cab so many times, that guy. I knew Tony Stratton Smith pretty well from representing him, and we were in a cab, me and Sherwood, when Games Without Frontiers came on the radio, and I said, "Hey, Bob, you like this record?" And he said, "What the hell is this record? I hear this record everywhere. I've heard it in the restaurant. I heard it in the hotel lobby. Here it is in the town." I said, "That's because it's the number one single in England. It's Peter Gabriel." I said, "You know, I guarantee you, it's 5 o'clock. I guarantee you, if we go over to Wardour Street to the Marquee Club, Tony Stratton Smith will be sitting there drinking a beer. And if we walk in and we say, you know, we want this record, I bet you anything we can have it." And Sherwood, to his credit, says, cabby, Wardour Street, please." And we walked in, and there was Tony, because I had to hunt him down at the bar. You know, if it was 5 o'clock, I knew not to call his office. So there he was, and I introduced him to Bob, and Bob says, "Tony, we'd love to have Peter Gabriel." And mid-sip, you know, Tony stops, he turns and he says, "Well, I've just been sitting here waiting for someone to say that very thing." You know? And so we got that Peter Gabriel album, and we sold, in its initial release, about 400,000 copies, which was very meaningful to Mercury Records at the time. So,
and yet then he left pretty quickly, right?
Thanks for pointing out that sore spot. You know, I got to tell you something. However many years later, I'm still angry about that, okay?
I got to tell these guys, the day that I met you, I think one of the first things you talked about, and I don't even remember how this came up. I think I had a local newspaper that said that John Hyatt...
Oh, you bastard!
That was one of the first things that I started talking about with Pete was...
That son of a bitch, I swear to God, you know? He's playing here in New York this week, and I thought, you know, maybe I'll just go to the gig and fuck with him, you know? just because I still owe him, you know, that. Sorry, I can't believe you.
Hope you're happy, Jeff.
I had nothing to do with it. I was in grade school.
Now I've downward spiraled into a depression that'll be with me for three days. So.
Your career is full of those great, Zelig-type stories. Right place, right time, personal connections, handshakes, friendships leading to deals. I would venture to guess you don't feel like the business still operates on that level.
No, not at all. I don't feel like the business operates very well at any level. So, and that one included.
What do you think, what kind of relationships do you think drive deals these days?
Well, I think data points drive deals these days, you know. In other words, some research analyst says, oh, well, they're getting this many hits on this, or they have this many friends, or they have, you know, whatever other data you can collect that somehow quantifies rather than qualifies the act to be recording artists.
Here's another question for you. As a guy who's been around the industry now close, I guess, about 40 years...
Ouch! No wonder my joints hurt. Jesus.
Yeah, welcome to my world.
Yeah.
Well, you did say since you were 12. Let's put it that way.
True.
Let's qualify that.
Okay.
Which would probably make you only
about 40 years. Yeah. Okay.
12 years older than me. So let's put it that way. So as a guy who's been around the industry for a long time, have you ever had the opportunity to kick Bob Lefsetz in the nuts?
You know, here, I go back with Bob Lefsetz to when he was truly, truly creepy. Do you guys know about... do you know about when he wrote that thing about Lisa Loeb?
No.
Oh, my God. Oh, jeez. Then you don't know Bob Lefsetz, okay? Bob Lefsetz... This newsletter used to arrive, as a mimeograph sheet or a Xerox, whatever you call it. I don't know. You know, it used to be a paper good that would come unsolicited in the mail. You know, you didn't ask for it. It was just forced on you by this guy, okay? And you had to beg to get him to stop sending these things to you. But what happened was... And they were, if you think he's somewhat immature now, you can't imagine what it was like back in 1987 or whenever he started doing it. But one time, he wrote a missive so vile and so lurid about how badly he wanted to hook up with Lisa Loeb that it really... It caused waves of nausea throughout the music industry. It did. Even, you know, venal hyenas were appalled, you know, by what he wrote that day. And people, there was a mass movement to, like, unsubscribe to Bob Lefsetz, which didn't take, although his mimeographed letter did take a big beating. Courtesy of that Lisa Loeb thing, but he clawed his way back. It's what when I think of Burt Bacharach, okay, I think of a guy who has women chained in his basement. And Bob Lefsetz, I think of as the guy next door who wishes he had girls chained in his basement.
Wow.
He, like, looks out the window all day long. Oh, you know, Bacharach has girls in the basement, you know.
It's the most brilliant analogy I think I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah.
Pete, I got a question for you. So before you kind of mentioned that one of the jobs that you got was kind of a result of you saying yes to an opportunity that you really had no business in saying yes to an opportunity to, because you didn't really know anything about the job that you were about to do. Is that correct?
That is absolutely 100% correct, yes.
Okay. And so much often comes out, I think, for a lot of people about, saying yes to an opportunity when you really don't know the situation, but then, figuring it out and succeeding. So I was wondering if you...
Which is how your mom has operated for so many years.
Ayo. So I was wondering if you could... if you could share, if you have another story of an example of a time when you said yes to an opportunity that you really didn't know a lot about but figured you could learn it, on the way.
Well, okay. I can expand on the first thing for a minute. When I got to Mercury Records, what I did was I stayed late every night and I snuck into the... business affairs department and into the file cabinets, and I pulled out the contracts of all the artists on the label, and I made a project of reading them all from start to finish, and I would stay on a page until I understood, every clause and every paragraph of that contract, and before I would move on, because Sherwood called me up very early in my tenure, and he said, hey, listen, Mellencamp's in the mastering lab, and he's editing the single, and he keeps insisting it's a recoupable cost, and I keep telling him, no, it's not, but I need you to weigh in, so what do you say, sport, recoupable, non-recoupable? And I had no idea what recoupable meant. So I said, Bob, I think I know which side of that equation I would fall on, but I want to check and be certain, so let me get right back to you, And then I waited until everyone went home, and I got John Cougar's contract, and I, went through it until I figured it out. And so that's how I figured out how to be an A&R man, well, at least the nuts and bolts part of how to be an A&R man. I didn't figure out how to be a good A&R man in terms of being any good at it until maybe the signing of Robert Cray, which I always think of as the one that transformed my consciousness from complete ego-driven, arrogant idiocy into somebody that could do the job properly.
So what was it about that?
Well, what I learned was the human mind is a rational organ. It strives to rely on rules that govern, your mobility through everyday life. That if you put a cup on the table, it's not going to fall through the table because the table is a hard surface. And you work with all these rules. In signing talent, there's thousands of rules. This guy will never happen for this reason, And in the case of Robert Cray, a black man that played the blues at modern rock radio in 1986, whatever it was, mm-hmm. That just was not going to fly. The blues is a sales ghetto. You'll never sell more than 35,000 copies. By the way, do you know he's black? so many reasons not to do that deal. And I had to, learn how to beat back the impulse to, adhere to all of those rules that can cloud your thinking when it comes to, doing things that are unique and distinctive, let's say. So when I boiled it down, and trust me, even up until the night before we did the deal, I got taken out to dinner by the then head of A&R at Polygram. And the guy who was my friend, we'd known each other long before we worked at this particular gig together, he said, I'm not telling you this as the department head. I'm telling you this as your friend. This will be your Waterloo. This will kill you. Don't do this deal, But I boiled it down after too many sleepless nights to, that voice on my label. I want that voice on my label. And, you know, to hell with all those other things that are telling me it's not going to be the right thing to do. And it's an ongoing thing. You know, you have to caution against those sorts of rational thoughts, you know, clouding your judgment a lot if you want to do good work. And so that's something I learned that time.
Wow.
Interesting, because it just seemed like, you know, think about it in retrospect. And when you said Mercury Records, that was one of the first things that popped into my head was a Strong Persuader.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to know that, to learn that you had worked with them. And it did seem like you're saying, yeah, there were so many things against it, but there were also so many, in addition to his talent, there were so many reasons why it could have worked.
No.
You know, it was at a time, you know, Stevie Ray and the Thunderbirds had already been signed also. You know, they had started to come about. And the fact that he wasn't doing straight blues, it was
more
geared towards up-tempo soul and maybe not to sell it to rock radio, but I remember, you know, thinking that if there was any time when that could have worked, it was at that very particular moment.
Hey, Dave, you know what you're doing? You're thinking about it. You see, you can't do that. Because if you think about it, the answer to all of those things that you just said is no, bad idea. Terrible idea. It's not going to work. You know, you just said, perhaps not on rock radio. Well, in 1986, if you didn't get on rock radio, your record didn't exist.
Yep.
So you couldn't make a record that you knew wasn't going to get on rock radio. It was unthinkable.
And it definitely didn't sound like rock radio.
Right. Although I hired a guy to mix it who I thought almost to a fault leaned a little over the edge of right down the throat of rock radio.
Right.
He had mixed, I think the most recent thing he had mixed before I hired him, I think, I could be wrong, was a David Lee Roth hit record. Yeah, but it was a big hit, and it was a well-made record. But you just sort of expressed, you know, all the hazards, because when I heard you running it down, to me it was like, okay, pass, can't do it, next. You know, but that's thankfully not what I did, because as you know, as maybe Jeff knows, I lived in Cray Manor out in the suburbs for many years thereafter. Yeah, that's what we called the joint. Yeah.
And now it's time for the endorsement section of the podcast, where each of us recommends something that we've been enjoying lately, and we will start with Pete.
I've chosen for my endorsement Kickstarter, which I think is just the greatest thing to come down the pike in a very long time. It enables all kinds of people to do all kinds of things, and certainly if we're being record industry centric, for example, there's a girl who I'll say discovered, for lack of a better word, many, many, many years ago, and I was never able to convince anybody that she is just utterly fantastic. And we parted ways after a long duet together, but I just noticed the other day that she had a Kickstarter project. She was asking for $20,000 to make her next record, and she got herself $33,000 to make a record, which is, wow, a considerable amount of money. You can do a world, yeah, of good with $33,000, and that's just one example, a heartwarming one to me, but one example out of thousands that are out there. People,
who is she?
Her name is Antje, Antje, Antje Duvekot, Duvekot, and I swear that on a good day she can write a song as good as Paul Simon, and I don't say all that right lightly. So, but you know, there are people that are making ice cream and making movies and making pens, as we know, and whatever else, and they get money. It takes the power. It's funny. It takes the power away from, certainly VC guys who can be as venal as record executives, and it makes everybody an angel investor, and I just think it does enormous good in the world, and it's a fantastic model, and I think it's great.
Okay, Jeff, I think that it might have been in that interview the three of us did with the Brown Tweet Society, where you spoke about the idea of Kickstarter and similar things like that as being a throwback to the old days of where patronage of the arts.
Yeah, definitely. And I know there are people who are kind of ambivalent about what that might mean long term, but at least in the short term, I'm inclined to agree very much with Pete.
What's the ambivalent part? Where do they? What makes them? What gives them pause about?
You know, to be honest with you, I really couldn't articulate what the what people see as the downside. I have heard what seems like a kind of a trendy backlash against Kickstarter and Pledge Music and places like that, though. I think it's great. I think that it provides an avenue for artists who, you know, historically speaking, have not sold enough records to merit the attention of the labels.
No, man. Forget the labels. Jesus. It lets people make records and it lets fans underwrite the endeavor because they want more. Well, then you said something about...
No, in the beginning, this was a model that was introduced as a way of kind of circumventing that. I think Marillion was one of the first bands that introduced what they called in the beginning a model. I think it was like you bought a share in the record, you know?
Yeah.
And the record ultimately was your dividend for buying in. But
I've actually thought about doing a Kickstarter.
For what?
Well, that's what I have to think of.
Your homemade ice cream.
Yeah, right now it's basically just, okay, give me money so that I don't have to go out and get a real job. So I could continue just like sitting around my house and, you know, drinking coffee and scratching myself.
Oh, that's my gig. You can't have that.
Well, we're in different parts of the country. You know, you could have the...
I have the Eastern region.
Chicago office.
Right, and I've got the Midwest.
Are you guys in dosing?
I've had barely any time with my job to really take in a lot of media. So honestly, and I know this will probably cause its own discussion in and of itself, but I've been using Spotify pretty much nonstop at work and on my phone recently just to listen to music and listen to some stuff that I wouldn't normally listen to. I've been listening to a lot of the Pop Dose writers' playlists, which has been a lot of fun and has helped me discover some new stuff. And where I particularly think they're getting it right is on the mobile side. I signed up for a trial of Mog a few months ago to see if I could use it as a good mobile service. And the mobile application I thought was abysmal. You know, you just couldn't get through more than 20 seconds of a track without it breaking up or stopping or rebuffering. And there's nothing worse than, you know, hearing a song that you're really interested in and then it stops, you know, 20 seconds in. And Spotify really seems to have this going really well. I haven't had any cutouts or anything like that. I'm very interested to see what Apple winds up doing in September with the iCloud service, because I do think that, you know, Apple has sold us a lot on the convenience of iTunes and the way that they've got things set up. And if they're able to do something like Spotify that has really great iTunes integration, I think that's going to be where a lot of people are going to head to. So, like, I listened to the Jay-Z Kanye West record most of the day on Friday, which I never would have listened to otherwise. And I'm glad I had a chance to listen to it. I actually quite like it.
Yeah, I've been listening to it all week.
Yeah, you like it?
When the kids are not around.
Yeah, right. Well, Spotify has the edited version as well.
Oh, that's a travesty. I would never do that.
Yeah.
I did my civic duty, and I downloaded the unedited version from iTunes on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the version that I have.
I told my mama I was on the come up. She said, you going to school, I give you a summer. Then she met no ID and gave me his number. 10 years later, she driving a Hummer. Niggas hustle every day for a beat from Ye.
what I do, turn around, get them beats to Jay. And I'm rapping on the beats they were supposed to buy. I guess I'm getting high on my own supply.
Okay, Jeff, what's your endorsement?
I'm going to talk about a band called Spirit Family Reunion that is, I think, out of Brooklyn. And before Dave starts screaming.
Yes, they're out of Brooklyn. They're not from Brooklyn.
I think they are from Brooklyn, but they don't sound like it. They sound like they're heavily influenced by acts like The Band.
Okay.
It's old-timey traditional stuff, but it's not as much of an empty homage as that kind of stuff can be.
The Macy Gray syndrome.
The Macy Gray
syndrome. I always think of Macy Gray, always, always, because, you know, she was supposed to be so real, and yet it was so clear that wasn't the case. You know, so I love your term, you know, like empty homage. That's excellent.
So it's more like along the Dawes axis, the Dawes middle brother.
I think these guys are a lot more interesting than Dawes.
Okay. But I mean, it's like the same Americana harmony type of thing.
I think Dawes sounds like something, like an echo of something that got left behind in Laurel Canyon. I think Spirit Family Reunion.
Yeah, I'll agree with that.
Sounds more like something that you would find in a mason jar.
Okay.
And I interviewed the band leader for Paste a couple of weeks ago, and mentioned to him that I thought it was striking that the tracks, there's a live video of theirs online that they did for some charity. And in that live video, they sound almost exactly the same as they do on their album. And I mentioned that to him, kind of trying to get at all the time and heartbreak and energy that they must have put into getting those harmonies down. And his response was that they really don't. That they really don't put much blood, sweat, and tears into any aspect of their sound. They just kind of play, and it happens. And part of me sort of sneers at that, but there's another part of me that thinks that's really kind of neat and refreshing and cool.
Well, you could say that it just reflects that they got together and started singing, and it just kind of hit, which is going into the, if you ever heard the story about how Crosby, Stills, and Nash formed at a party, you know, they were just kind of singing, and then Nash came along and added a third part to it and was like, holy shit.
Yeah, but the weird part about that story is none of them can sing. You know, but Jeff, to your point, I mean, people, if they're skilled harmony singers, if they have the ability to sing harmony, and I got to tell you, that's the part. If I make a record with somebody, and the singers can think up and perform harmony parts, you know, on the fly, you know, they can just go out and do it. That's always the part of the session that I'm the most awestruck by.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredible. It's amazing. You know, especially because A, I'm completely tone deaf, and B, you know, I could only wish I could sing. That it's not that hard for people who have that ability.
I'm always impressed with Jason because I think singing live harmony is horrifying. I always have. It's like trying to ride a unicycle on a tightrope over a fire.
Right.
I mean, it's
yeah.
But then again, it is the single most brilliant thing in the world.
His response was that these guys came up essentially busking, like in subway stations and on the street where you got to play loud in order to get people's attention. And so when they wrote songs, they gravitated toward keys that he could sing loud in. Mm-hmm. And he just happened to be playing with people who could harmonize in those same keys. And it sounds great. And to go back to the Spotify thing, these guys are not, they're only selling their CD. You have to email them to get it. And they'll put it in a padded envelope and mail it to you, which is ridiculous. I mean, they're burning the CD. You know, they're still using technology, obviously, but it seems so fucking quaint in this day and age. I mean, I had to ask him, when are you going to make your CD more readily available? And he kind of laughed and said, well, seems like it's pretty easily available to me.
It'll roll in from the east, like the ships return from sea. It'll ring out through the west. Across Golden Valley, rising up from the south. Oh, that's where I wanna be.
there's someone here calling me. When my name is spoken, I will.
All right, and for me, I will endorse one of my favorite bands on the planet have just released a new album, and that is the Jones Beach Boys, better known to the world as Fountains of Wayne. their fifth album is out now, Sky Full of Holes. I didn't like their last album, Traffic and Weather. I think it was a bit of a disappointment. I think most people consider it a disappointment. But Sky Full of Holes is just fucking brilliant. It's a little bit quieter than their previous efforts. It's more acoustic driven, but the things that you just expect from Adam Schlesinger and Chris Collingwood, those pure pop melodies and with those lyrics that are so detailed and so wry, it's just such a great record. I'm absolutely loving it. There's a song that I love called A Road Song, which it harkens back to, actually it's a combination of two of their previous songs, which was I-95 from Traffic and Weather and Prom Theme from Utopia Parkway. It's writing a road song about a road song. You know, hey, I'm just calling to say I'm writing you a road song. And there's a line, you'll say it's not necessary, and I know that I'm no Steve Perry. and so it's just like this really sweet song, and then that line hits you, and it's just like, wow, that's just brilliant. I just love the hell out of this band, and I think that this may even be better than it definitely rivals Welcome Into State Managers and Utopia Parkway as their best work.
Dave, you're saying this new record is not too clever by half?
Oh, well, everything they do is incredibly clever, and just has all those that kind of wise-ass thing. But I think that they've tuned down the wise-assness, but they've kept the detail, the humorous detail.
Cool.
And also kept the emotion in there as well. I think, like, if you look at Hey Julie from Welcome Interstate Managers, you know, that is like the perfect example of what they're doing on this record.
Well, it would behoove them to do all those things that you described, so it's probably a record worth checking out, because they're certainly skilled at what they do.
Did I happen to say, hey, I've been writing you a road song, don't run away, cause hey, I promise it won't be too long, I know it's not what you call necessary.
And that's going to do it for this episode of the Pop Does Podcast. Our thanks to Pete Lubin for joining us on the show today.
The sound of one hand clapping.
Okay. You can, as always, you can find back episodes of the show on iTunes. And while you're there, please leave us a review because it helps give the show greater exposure. Follow us on Twitter at PopDose. And we'll be back with another show next month, hopefully. Jason and Jeff, what should we talk about?
Well, I believe we're going to have Brian Boone on the show, aren't we?
Yep.
Yes, we are.
He's supposed to be sending you guys copies of the book.
I've got it.
I am
excellent.
About to start reading it. Yep. I'm finishing up something else for a review that I'm doing for PopDose.
I was almost angry when it was over.
Yeah, I've been reading it in fits and starts, which is a great way to read that book. And I'm very much looking forward to finishing it and talking about it next month.
Pete, before we go, do you have anything you want to plug?
Jason's dad. I mean, that guy was a...
You want to plug Jason's dad?
No, whoa.
He was a floor show all by himself. I only wish I could have been as amusing as him as a guest, and I'm wondering where he's appearing next. That's all.
Yeah. Be careful. If he hears this episode, he might, you know, he's just two towns over. He might show up on your doorstep. It could happen.
Okay, Katie, bar the door.
I will let him know that someone as prestigious and influential as you,
delectable,
listened and enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Well, when we started talking that day, I was just like, "Oh my God, this is Buddy Hackett."
And you guys didn't think it was going to work.
No, Jeff did. I just didn't know your dad. Yeah, and I didn't know, like, what I was going to say to him. So I just, came up with those two questions, and he just rolled with it from there.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
I knew it was going to work. I just didn't have any idea how well.
Yeah.
And I have such sympathy for your mom, you know.
Yeah.
I know that's not popular at Poptos.
Right? She does have the patience of a saint. It's pretty impressive.
She must.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen.
Well, okay.
We should do it again sometime. Yeah.
Yes, we definitely should.
I agree.
We could have you on a million times and never run out of stuff to talk about. So thanks for being on. You'll definitely join us again.
Maybe you can replace Jason.
Oh my God.
By the way, Dave, when you put this show together, you'll notice how quiet he really was. I think he was sadly overwhelmed by my presence. But
I know. I think this is the best episode we've ever done because of that.
Oh my God!
No, Pete, I couldn't get a word in.
At one point. At one point, I almost said, "Hey, Jason, chime in anytime." You know.
See, I'd never say that.
No, I was here. I listened to the whole thing. I wasn't going to contribute with something stupid and childish. I thought,
"Oh, there's a first."
Yeah, right.
No, God, Jason, you're taking it from all sides right now.
I know, seriously.
Just like your mom.
God, I'm sorry.
Anytime, boys. All right, guys. Anytime.
Okay. Thanks again, Pete.
Thanks, Pete. Okay.
All right.
Cheers.
All right.
Bye, everybody. So, Dave, are you working on a... is it true, the rumors that you're working on a Michelle Bachmann book?
We'll see.
Freshly minted straw poll winner.
Yeah.
That's
Michelle Bachmann. And champion footlong corn dog eater, too.
Yeah, I saw that picture.
Holy mackerel.
Oh, I didn't see that. Hold on.
Oh, look it up, bud.
Let me Google Michelle Bachmann corn dog.
Whoever is running her team is either a genius or needs to be fired. I can't decide which.
Oh, my God. Sorry. Guess what I just saw?
Michelle Bachmann eating a giant corn dog.
Hang on. Jessica, come here. You have to see this picture of Michelle Bachmann eating a corn dog. Oh, man, an advertisement just popped up. Hold on. You gotta see this photo. We're recording, so just FYI. But look at this. That's Michelle Bachmann eating a... Look at her.
Hi, Jess.
Dave says hello. She says hi. But, sorry, I just had to call her in to look at this photo of Michelle Bachmann eating a corn dog.
It's a sight to behold.
Wow. Just sitting here staring at this picture. I just...
Stop jerking off.
I'm just flabbergasted. It's like the Newsweek cover. Like, I just can't turn away. I just have to keep looking at it. Like, what?
Somebody let that happen.